This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Der Dezember steckt voller Gewinne mit dem Rubbellos Adventskalender. 24 mal rubbeln, 24 mal die Chance auf festliche Sofortgewinne. Mit Gesamtgewinnen von mehr als 4,5 Millionen Euro über alle Winterlose hinweg. Ich bin dann mal weg.
Rubbellose, das schnellste Glück von Lotto. Chance auf einen der Höchstgewinne, siehe Rückseite der Lose.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease, and we're celebrating age rather than beauty this week.
If you lose those individuals and your age structure suddenly becomes much younger, then that's potentially detrimental to everyone of all ages in that population.
Why maturity may matter when conserving wildlife. Also, the chimps who share with us humans an ability to advance and share technology. And a new attempt to learn about life at the bottom of the Pacific is underway.
We need to understand why these organisms are there, so rare, how they can live there, even without considering the potential disturbance through mining.
First, hurricanes.
More than 3 million people are without power in Florida as Hurricane Milton continues to batter the
state. Biblical devastation. The words of emergency officials as they battle the leftovers of the tropical storm.
Flood warnings have been issued as heavy rain falls over much of
the state. The damage has exceeded the damage of Idalia and Debbie combined.
North and South Carolina are the latest states in its path of destruction, with the highest death toll so far.
Global warming really is making hurricanes stronger, according to a study just published in the journal Environmental Research. This always seems simple. More energy in the system means more and or stronger storms. But it's not so simple, with many factors affecting the way hurricanes develop. Only 10 or 20 happening in a typical year. And incomplete records going back in time, the statistics have been very hard to pin down. The new study from the US research group Climate Action is definitive, though, saying that top wind speeds are on average 30 kilometres per hour higher than before global warming. And a quick application of their methods to this year's hurricane season confirms it too has been massively boosted. Here's the lead analyst, Daniel Guilford.
So on average, the temperatures along the track of these storms were something like 2 degrees Celsius warmer than they would have been about 100 years ago. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but if you can imagine that I bumped up your body temperature by 2 degrees Celsius, you'd be running a fever. And the Atlantic Ocean is running a fever. And in order to get rid of that, it has these extra intensity, these hurricanes that can sort of sweep over, see that extra heat, and then begin to intensify. We're seeing that many storms in 2024 on average intensified by about 30 kilometers per hour.
30 kilometers. So that's, I mean, how much of a difference does that make in the sort of the classical strength that the people use, the categories?
Right. So we classify hurricanes with something called the Saffir-Simpson scale from a categories 1 to a category 5. And in general, these hurricanes are being intensified by about one category, a little bit more than one category. And that matters a lot because the amount of damage that is related to a hurricane sort of scales with its wind speed. So a more intense storm is going to generally have more damages associated with it. And indeed, we saw a very damaging 2024 hurricane season along the Gulf and eastern Atlantic coasts.
Milton, for example, quite recently that hit Florida with pretty catastrophic effects. That was Category 5. You're saying that would not have been a Category 5 if there'd been no global warming.
That's right. In fact, we had two hurricanes this year, Beryl and Milton, that were both Category 5. And according to our analysis, they both would have been Category 4 hurricanes instead. So they would have, you know, come on shore with less damaging effects than in a world without climate change. But unfortunately, that's not the world we live in. We live in a world that has been warmed by climate change.
But you see that kind of boost also with some of the other hurricanes this year?
So one of the ones that stands out to me really significantly is Hurricane Rafael, which hit Cuba just 2 weeks ago. And we saw it was a hurricane category 3 right before it made landfall in Cuba. And we found in our analysis that the waters were quite a bit warmer, more than 2 degrees Celsius warmer just off the coast of Cuba. And associated with that, Hurricane Rafael would have been actually a category 1 without human caused climate change. So a change in two categories caused by climate change, really showing that these climate change effects are stretching later and later into the year and influencing storms that can happen even in November.
I've been talking to scientists, it feels, for so many years about whether there is this kind of effect. You know, how certain are you that it is the warm waters as opposed to, I don't know, what other factors? You know, because you're dealing with a kind of counterfactual here, it seems.
That's exactly right. So this counterfactual, this idea that there's a world without human-caused climate change, and to what extent does that influence these storms? We can make a number of different assumptions to sort of test, are other factors playing a role? So one of the things that we did in our study is we were worried that human emissions of aerosols, which were very prominent in the 1960s and 70s in the Atlantic Ocean, they were reducing the temperatures in that period. So if we analyze hurricanes only going back to the 70s, we would get a incorrect picture of what's actually driving the change. So in order to make sure that this isn't what we would move past that assumption, we did the analysis, the same analysis we did back to the 1960s and 70s. We did also back to 1900 using a longer term data set. It's a little bit coarser resolution, a little bit sort of poor data quality just because it's further back in time, but it really gives us a good sense that climate change has been changing sea surface temperatures in this region for over 100 years now, and they're indeed driving these changes in intensity. Another concern we had was that sort of non-local changes, changes in other parts of the ocean, could actually reduce the intensity of hurricanes in the North Atlantic Ocean, and that's something we evaluated in our study. And we found that it can reduce our influences by something like 40%. But in general, the primary sort of mover on what is driving changes in intensity for any given hurricane on average is increases in sea surface temperature.
One of the confusing factors here is whether global warming was going to create more hurricanes, which a lot of people have said is all rubbish, or whether it's just going to make them more intense, like you're saying. In a funny way, I feel that this year, 2024, which hasn't had an exceptional number of storms, sort of makes the case that it really is the intensity that matters.
Yeah, one of the things that we find is that it seems like there's differences between locations around the world as far as whether there will be more or less hurricanes with climate change. And there are still quite a number of groups that are doing research on this exact question. Our analysis is really focused on the intensity. We can evaluate how environmental conditions, especially sea surface temperature warming, can influence the intensity of hurricanes once we have a hurricane to begin with. So this analysis can't speak particularly to changes in frequency. But it is an ongoing concern because, you know, the number of storms you have as it bumps up or bumps down, as the case may be, it'll influence how many different locations around the world will be hit by these storms.
And is the heat in the ocean, is that a very important part of this? Because we have talked in a few times in recent years about rapid intensification, which seems to be linked to warm waters very close to the coast, which are then making things very difficult.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we focus in this particular study on the waters that are underneath the storm as it intensified and sort of reached its peak intensity before making landfall. And indeed, along these paths of these storms, we do see warm waters, especially in the Atlantic Ocean. But in general, waters all across the world are increasing in temperature, and that tends to increase the amount of available energy that these storms can take, convert in this fuel form from the ocean surface into winds that then are damaging for communities.
So what we've just seen, for example, in the Philippines, where I think they've just been battered by four typhoons, which are essentially hurricanes in another part of the world, but four typhoons in very quick succession. And you're saying, well, this is exactly what we're expecting.
I think it's difficult to say, you know, whether there'll be more or less storms in the future. There seems to be some research that suggests there actually might be a fewer storms in the Western Pacific, but I think research in that space is ongoing. What we do know is that these typhoons, as they track towards the Philippines, moved over waters that were made somewhere between 10 and 40 times more likely to be as warm as they were, which was something like half a degree up to a degree Celsius warmer because of human-caused climate change. Mm. And so we did see this this increasing warmth along the track of these typhoons, but I would not go so far as to speak to the sort of the number of these storms, because my research can't speak to that.
Right. Interesting caution there. I mean, it matters because, as I understand it, the intensity is the sort of driver of the damage, that it's not an increase of one category can actually make a can completely transform how damaging a hurricane is.
That's right. We know that the sort of the amount of damages from a storm scales with the wind speed. My colleague John Morales yesterday was pointing out sometimes up to 8 to the power of 8 in terms of wind speed. So there's this increase of, if you take the wind speed and multiply it by the wind speed again and again and again 8 times, you'll find that that's sort of the proportional amount of damage you might expect. So an increase in just a little bit of the wind speed can have a huge effect on how much damage you experience. We are experiencing this indeed in the United States, where we're seeing billion-dollar disasters frequently here. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has been showing that the billion-dollar disasters in the United States are now happening on average once every 9 days. And so these changes in disasters that are unnatural changes caused by human-caused climate change are going to be, you know, with us for a long time, and we're paying the cost right now. And hurricanes are an important part of that.
Well, it does seem to me that that's such an important part of the message, is that an incremental change in global temperature doesn't mean an incremental change in the amount of in the human cost or the economic cost. You start sort of not quite going past thresholds, but you're seeing multipliers playing in.
That's exactly right. Climate change is expensive. It's easier to sort of deal with, you know, reduce our costs up front by reducing our reliance on fossil fuels and other greenhouse gases than it is to pay for the costs later on an ongoing basis, because we didn't reduce our reliance on those things.
Daniel Guilford of Climate Action on the costs of climate inaction. There's more to looking after our planet than just our impact on its climate. There's conservation too. The fact that species are going extinct as fast now as in some of the great geological extinction events is pretty alarming. Obviously, there are many organisations trying to halt the trend, as well as UN agencies. Science magazine this week carries an unusual plea for conservationists to focus not just on the numbers and distribution of the animals they're saving, but also their age. Now, from where I'm sitting, there's a lot to be said for maturity. But I wanted co-author Lauren Brent to reassure me that's true more broadly across ecology.
So if you are a fish, let's say, many fish keep growing as they age, and they keep reproducing in vast quantities. And because reproduction scales with body size, then if you're an older fish, you're producing vast more numbers of fish eggs than if you're a younger fish. So in terms of reproduction, then that individual is much more important, let's say, for scaling importance by how many babies you make, than a younger individual.
And just to labour the point, the large fish are the ones which are both the easiest to catch and the easiest to eat. So there's a very particular case in the example of marine conservation.
They're a very particular case, and that's why in the paper many of the authors are focused in on fisheries management.
But if I were to extend this then to, I don't know, mice or bats or small mammals that go around foraging on berries, it doesn't seem to me that age is a big deal in their case.
Yeah, so we tried to make the distinction between different types of species. So a mouse is something that we would class as a fast pace of life history animal. And a bat, bats are some of the longest lived mammals that we know of. So a bat is a very slow life history strategist, which means it's slow to get going. So it's slow to start reproducing. And then it lives a very long time. Whereas a mouse, you know, on average lives 2 or 3 years. So then it could differ. Those two things, then if we follow that trajectory, if you're a bat, if you're an old individual bat and you live in a social group, then your long lifespan might mean that you've accrued information that younger members of your population haven't. And because they're exposed to you and your behavior, they can pick things up they can benefit from your old age and experience in ways that a mouse probably can't, because their elder is only, you know, a few months older than them.
you're at the Center for Research in Animal Behavior. So presumably you look at some of these in great detail. Is there a particular example that you cherish, as it were?
Absolutely. So I study social behavior in particular. And so we've shown, for example, in elephants that when there's a congregation of male elephants at a watering hole, if an all-male is around, that the younger individuals, so those feisty teenage elephants, let's just say, react less to things in their environment, be it a noise, be it another animal approaching, be it a truck, right? So if we're thinking about ecotourism and human-wildlife conflict, then the presence of an old individual can dampen some of those things. And if we remove those older individuals from the population, then the younger individuals potentially suffer in terms of being able to find their way around their environment, but they also interact with us in ways that perhaps we don't enjoy and would like to discourage them from doing.
I guess the other side of this is, have you got any evidence? Obviously, you were talking just now about fish, where there's a special case, but that older individuals are being more harmed or disproportionately harmed by human activities at the moment.
There are clear examples in other types of animals, trophy hunting, for example, where older individuals are the preferred take when we're talking about vertebrates as well. In addition to, there are effects, of course, of things like habitat loss that can affect older members of populations. If we think about senescence, older members of populations are sometimes a bit more vulnerable. Disturbance can occasionally hit them harder, be that directly like hunting or be that something simply as habitat loss, disease spread.
I mean, it sort of sounds like it's not that there is some kind of universal rule about age that you're addressing, but that the factor of age is being overlooked.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's almost as if we have these case studies peppered around the fisheries example, reproduction, enhanced experience and knowledge as an example. And what we want to do is we want to pull these together and highlight them, and in particular, highlight all the things that we don't know and the complexity that age and the age structuring of populations presents to us as biologists, whether we're interested simply in the functioning and structure of societies, the evolution of species, or if we're interested in conserving biodiversity on the planet.
Time and again, the story I'm hearing is that the biggest pressure that we put on wildlife is through habitat destruction. Can you conceive of ways in which land use could be moderated to help preserve older animals, older individuals, or do you just, you don't want to cut down the trees anyway?
No single species relies on a single ecosystem, right? So they're all interconnected webs that it's very difficult when it comes to habitat. You know, you preserve a habitat, then you ideally preserve everything in it. Can it help us with our limited time and resources choose which habitats are going to preserve the most, perhaps? Potentially. And can conserving old individual members of certain populations have knock-on effects for ecosystems? We've argued in the piece that absolutely that's possible, given their role in those ecosystems is often quite disproportionate. Not only old individual members of populations, but those longer-lived species in general.
And you do have one that's very specific recommendation, which is that the International Union for the Conservation of Nature Red List, so these catalogues of endangered species, you say that age isn't part of the checklist which they should include.
Right, yeah, it's not. So they don't consider the age structure of a population when they're evaluating that population and whether it should be listed as under threat or not. And what we're saying is that for some populations, that's going to be incredibly important. If your old individuals are the ones who pass on information due to their enhanced experience, if they are helping younger members of their population raise their offspring. If you lose those individuals and your age structure suddenly becomes much younger, and that's something we should be quite familiar with because our population is getting younger, then that's potentially detrimental to everyone of all ages in that population.
Lauren Brent, behavioural ecologist from Exeter University. A reminder, this is Science in Action from the BBC, appropriately the most mature science programme, we believe, on radio anywhere, in this corner of the universe at least. As Lauren said, with maturity comes wisdom. It accumulates, and human progress is based on the fact also that we can share it, culture. So, too, do our cousins the chimps, something we may have shared since our lineages diverged 6 million years ago. Obviously, to different degrees. But Cassandra Gunasekaram and Andrea Miliano, also behavioural ecologists, wanted to know how deep that runs. Not just the sharing, but the ability to innovate by combining skills to achieve more complex tasks and sharing those. Not having a time machine, they turned to two maps. One of chimp behaviours across Africa, another of their genetic diversity and inheritance, to see what that would reveal. First, what looks like a skill for chimps? Here's Andrea.
So most of the social animals that we work with will have some kind of cultural traditions. Chimpanzees are known to have culture since 1999. So they have different traditions in different populations that we consider they are not genetic or environmentally determined. They're passing from individual to individual. Now, cumulative culture is something that has always been characterized as a human thing. For instance, if you get something like a computer mouse, it's a very simple object, but it's so complex if you think about it. No one in the single world can recreate it alone from zero, because it requires someone to transform the oil in plastic, it requires the electronics, it requires the technology, knowledge. So it's beyond the capacity of one individual. And that's what we call cumulative culture. That is basically what determines human culture. But chimpanzees have some complex tools with multiple parts. For instance, they can crack nuts using one hammer, one anvil to have below the hammer, and even a stabilizer below it, so it makes a flat platform. This has three pieces. So you were wondering whether this is also cumulative. That means that different parts were added through step-by-step process and through multiple minds in the population.
As it were, a chimp might see another chimp doing something and then think, I can do better than that. And sort of, and then they share that, the other chimps see that them doing that. And so there's a kind of accumulation, like you say, of these behaviours.
Yeah, so it's not, I mean, the important thing is they don't teach each other, but they can observe from relatively close. So maybe when you have mutual observation, they're clever enough that they perhaps can combine this step.
Now, as I understand it, Cassandra, part of your attempt to see how to unravel this is that there are different populations of chimpanzees across Africa, and they have some overlapping skills, but they also have different skills. And this is a clue to how this kind of tool use might be cumulative.
Yeah, so we looked at many populations of chimpanzees across the whole range of chimpanzees in Africa. And we do see that some populations have specific traits, whereas the others don't. And what we had a look at is that some of these traits have a complex form and some have a simple form. For example, we have an underground digging stick. So this is a stick that they use to dig for underground honey in underground beehives, or underground termites from underground termite mounds. And then some populations have the simple form, and other populations have a complex form where they combine this digging stick with a second stick to collect the honey or the termites.
I guess the difficult thing, though, is for you is that you can see what they're doing now, and if you're talking about these behaviours being cumulative, then you need to have something that represents history. In other words, how you can know that it was one thing maybe 100 years ago and another thing 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, so of course in our study we cannot really pinpoint the time when or where exactly these traits were accumulated as such, but we can show that the populations that do have these complex versions are connected to each other genetically. So this means that there has been some sort of migration between these populations at some point in time in the past. And this suggests that these complex traits do rely on social learning and might be too complex to be invented multiple times in different places.
So the fact that chimpanzees can, I think it's the females, is that right, can move from one group to another, gives you a clue to the fact that they may be taking some kind of behavior with them, and then the new group says, you know, watches that and starts to use it as well.
Exactly. So females migrate in chimpanzees when they reach adulthood. They leave their old community to avoid inbreeding, and they take their genes with them, and then they also take their knowledge with them, and then they may be able to express these behaviors in the new community.
So seeing this requires, as far as I can tell, you've got a huge database of the behaviors. You've got another database of all the genetics, and you're trying to match them up. I mean, at any point, did you think this is hopeless?
We struggled in the beginning because Cassie was not finding any correlations, and many people said, oh, it's going to be impossible to find this. No, it's not the same as humans. And then we realized that what was happening is that we are not separating simple tools from complex tools. And when we did that, and we did the correlation separately, you see that simple tools are not correlating with the migration because they're so simple that they can be reinvented. And when we have only the complex tools, they're really correlated with these migrations, the genetic data. So it means that it's much more difficult for them to reinvent those tools. And therefore, it's probably through the social learning and passing from population to population like we observe in humans.
Why do you want to make that comparison?
Yeah, so I think it's very important that every time that we try to say, okay, humans are different from other primates because of this specific point, then of course people go and find something very similar in other primates. And that's because evolution does not happen with one mutation that changes everything, right? It's a 6 million years difference between humans and chimpanzees in very different niches. And so what we thought is if something is very characteristic of humans, like cumulative culture, and it's based on their social structure, and hunter-gatherers live in a very flexible social structure with a lot of mobility and recombination of information, can we find the basis of, I mean, the birth of this behavior in the common ancestor between humans and chimpanzees? And perhaps because humans occupied a niche where cooperation was much more important, they had to explore new environments in the savanna and so on, the hominins, they had to take this capacity to the maximum. So that was the rationale. I worked with hunter-gatherers for many years, and we knew the process of recombination of information in hunter-gatherers and the importance of mobility, but it sounded a little bit too hopeless that this is something that appeared in humans and only in humans. And then we went to look at this in chimpanzees, and luckily this data set just came out a year ago, so we were in the right place to do it.
Andrea Miliano and Cassandra Gunasekaram of the Department of Evolutionary Anthropology at Zurich University. Finally, to the deep, where very little changes and life is slow. Or it was, until some of us humans thought it was a good place to harvest rare minerals. We've talked previously about the Clarion-Clipperton Fracture Zone, 5 kilometres down in the central Pacific, where potato-sized metallic nodules have precipitated onto the seabed over millions of years in the cold, still waters. They're what the commercial interest is in. The rest is soft sediments and, it seems, numerous species yet to be discovered that have adapted themselves to the dark, nutrient-starved conditions, indeed attaching themselves to those nodules often to rise above the dirt. The French research vessel L'Atlante is heading out there with kit to core and bring up samples that'll reveal more about that delicate ecosystem. And project leader Pierre-Antoine Desondiers spoke to me as they readied to sail.
When you think about the biodiversity there, it's quite complex because what we can see using videos at the seabed is mostly the big animals that are attached to these nodules. But it's not super abundant. But there is a lot of fauna that are very small size that are encrusted in nodules attached to them and living in the sediment surrounding them. So this is what we need to study, and this is what we need to describe for the species. And we need to know the connection between the larger organisms and these small compartments of the fauna.
You can collect anything from a few centimeters long down to single-celled or bacteria. You're expecting to find things that have never been seen before.
Yeah.
Is that exciting?
Of course it is. It's a complex cruise because everything is super deep, and at these depths, everything becomes more complicated. So we need to have quite a good weather. We need to have good conditions to have everything working well. And then as soon as you collect this cores, you need to identify everything and you need to extract all the organisms. So it's a huge task, but it is super exciting, yeah, to describe new species and to figure out what is living there and what is the real biodiversity of this system is quite exciting, yeah.
So in a sense, you will be seeing how critical the nodules are to some of the ecosystems that exist down there, because I imagine that life is incredibly slow. It's presumably pretty cold down there. There's no light. So the way these organisms live is going to be very different from what we might think of up here.
Yeah, it is super deep, quite cold, completely dark. That means that for many of these organisms, the metabolic rates are super slow. So yeah, the behavior of the organisms living there is completely different than what we can observe in coastal areas. And that means that we need to really check in the behavior and the ecology, how they do live, what are the control parameters that make them able to survive in this kind of very harsh environment. So this is also the question that we do explore during this kind of cruise.
The reason we keep talking about the Clarion-Clipperton Fracture Zone is because there are these proposals to collect the nodules and use them for industry. I presume that you expect your findings to help the discussion whether that's safe or wise.
Yeah, the idea is that, as I said, there is a lot of species that needs to be described. There is a lot of lacking information in that system. And what we would like to do is just to provide another pack of information and another clue for the biodiversity in the system, the interaction between species, how they can connect from an area to another, how they could react to a potential disturbance. So that's the idea, to sort of anticipate what could be the impact. But also we need to understand, because of this context, we have the chance to do real theoretical science. So we also consider to try to answer to some larger questions. How do they live in this particular environment that is so deep, so dark, so complex? And what can we learn from this system regarding this biodiversity from the very deep environment?
And there have been some, I think, experimental trawls of mining these areas. Are you going to visit any places that have been disturbed? Because presumably that would give you some information about how they are affected and whether there's any recovery.
We did collect some samples in this area a couple of years ago, just right after the trial of the nodule collector. And the idea is in collaboration with all the European community, the colleagues that we were working with all along the last years, we will still collaborate with them and collect some new samples in order to have a temporal survey of this area and try to see how do the fauna react to this disturbance. Which fauna can still be there? What are the communities that were there just right after the trial of the collector, but finally are decreasing? Because that's the reality of the system. Some of the organisms can survive just right after the disturbance, but at the end, they don't reproduce. They don't have occurrence of new species. And we need to check in a temporal survey how this community is evolving through time.
You probably get used to working in these areas. You're about to go and have another look. How would you convey why this remote, inaccessible region is interesting to us?
We need to understand why these organisms are there, so rare, how they can live there, how they can survive, that make the story very interesting. And when we try to think how these work and how these organisms, how they interact with each other, how they behave, can they move, where do they collect the energy that they need? All these questions can be a very exciting project in any case. without considering the potential disturbance through mining.
Pierre-Antoine Descendier aboard L'Atlante, which will explore life in those dark depths into next January. We'll be back with more Science in Action from the BBC next week with, we're hoping, a look back to the experiments 50 years ago that crystallised our understanding of the nature of matter, the quarks and the things that make up our universe. Happy half-centenary to the Standard Model. Do join me, Roland Pease, and producer Alex Mansfield for the celebrations.